From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air.
Josh, you're probably gay.
I'm not.
Today, comedian Josh Thomas talks about creating and starring in the Australian series Please Like Me. It's now on Pivot TV, a new cable network in the U.S. When Thomas first pitched the show,
I was straight and the show was about Josh, like, having trouble dating girls.
But then Thomas realized he was gay and had to rewrite the show as well as a stand-up routine.
I, like, built all this material, which was all true stories about bad dates I had with girls and, like, terrible things that happened while I was trying to have sex with girls. And I had to lose all my stand-up, which is just heartbreaking, to lose all your jokes.
Also, Milo Miles reviews the new album from the band Tennis, and we remember Pulitzer Prize-winning editorial cartoonist Tony Auth. He died yesterday at age 72. That's coming up on Fresh Air. First news. This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. The character Josh is straight, at least he thinks he is, when the first episode of Please Like Me begins. But before that episode concludes, he's kissed a boy and realized he's gay. Please Like Me is a semi-autobiographical sitcom created by and starring my guest Josh Thomas, a 27-year-old Australian comic and popular TV personality. Please Like Me was created for Australian TV, but was picked up here last year by the new cable channel Pivot, which is geared to millennials. Pivot is currently showing season 2. Reviewing the show in Entertainment Weekly, Melissa Meritz wrote, "Too few shows are able to capture the real voice of 20-somethings, so Please Like Me's take on post-collegiate life feels particularly spot-on." In Time magazine, James Poniewozik included it on his 2013 10 Best list. The two Joshes, Josh Thomas and the character he plays, have several things in common besides their sexual orientation. Their parents are divorced, they're close with their mothers, and their mothers have attempted suicide. Let's start with the opening of the first episode. Josh is with his girlfriend in a restaurant where they've just been served an enormous, colorful ice cream sundae.
Isn't it just mind-blowing to think we actually get to eat this?
Josh, I want to talk to you about something.
Oh, no. No. No, you don't.
I think we should break up.
Oh. Oh, that's bad.
I kind of feel like we've drifted, you know?
This isn't good at all.
Also, you're gay.
What? No, I'm not.
Josh, you're probably gay.
I'm not.
I mean, we could still be friends, if you like. It wouldn't be really that different, would it?
Is $19 Sunday suddenly pretty humiliating?
That's a scene from Please Like Me, written and starring my guest, Josh Thomas. Josh Thomas, welcome to Fresh Air. So do you think one of your girlfriends figured out before you did that you were gay?
No, they didn't. That's not autobiographical. I mean, the poor girls, I don't know what they're thinking now, because I haven't spoken to any of them, the girlfriends that I had when I was teenagers. I was never confronted like that by a girl.
So why did you want to start the series with that scene?
I just thought it was a funny idea. I thought it was a funny idea, a girl telling me that I was gay over a sundae, just a delicious sundae, just me thinking I'm going to have the best day ever and her just confronting me with this news. I think maybe it happened to a friend or something. Someone told me a story and happened to them.
So I read that when you pitched Please Like Me, when you pitched the series, that you still were working under the assumption that you were straight. So
I was working under the assumption, yeah. For a lot of my life, I was working under the assumption I was straight. And then and then I met a boy and I fell in love with him. And then we had to change the pitch during development. Because we were in development in Australia since I was 20 for like 4 or 5 years. Because it's a government TV station, so things are really slow. It's like making a TV show with the post office, you know. So it took a long time. And I was straight, and the show was about Josh, like, having trouble dating girls. And then one day I had to, like, sit the producer and the network down and tell them there was some script changes.
Give me a sense of what that conversation was like. Well, from now on, the character Josh, you know, is going to be gay.
Well, I didn't. And actually, look, it was pretty bad. I didn't tell a lot of people because I just didn't, like the character on the show, I just didn't want to make a big deal out of it. And I just didn't think it was a thing I had to do, right? So I text message to my dad. Okay. My mom called me and she said, "Josh, what's this I hear about you having a boyfriend?" I said, "I can't chat him on the train." And she said, "I'm okay." And that was the end of like the conversations I had about it. Like I sort of told my friends and they didn't care. And then my manager was doing all like the professional calls, like calling the TV show I worked for and the development and the producer of Please Like Me. But he forgot to call the producer. And no one told him. And then everyone had been telling him I was gay. And he was like, "It's just rumors. You guys gotta stop making this up, right? Like, this is like, you know, I know him. He's not gay." And then it turns out that it just no one told him.
Well, that's hysterical. The producer didn't know. But you had to change the whole premise.
Yeah, so we were like sitting down with him. And he was like, "What is this I hear about you being gay?" And I was like, "Well, no one told you." And then I was, like, being all blasé about it. And he was like, "No, this is, like, a big deal. Like, we've got, like, development money to make this show. And we have to, like, change the scripts. We have to, like, talk to them. This is, like, a big deal." And I just sort of laughed it off.
But you were able to make the changes.
We made the changes, yeah. But we weren't sure as well, like, how people... Because we were like, you know, does a character need to be gay? It's not me. You know, these are the scripts we've got. Why does it need to change? But I think now...
Well, that's a good question. Why did it need to change?
I just think people would feel awkward watching me pretend to like girls. Plus, why not make him gay? I mean, it just would have been offensive to have this show that's autobiographical and for me to be straight. I mean, so just a weird choice to make.
So what was it like to not only make this big change in your life, but have it immediately be represented on screen in your portrayal of a semi-autobiographical character?
Well, I mean, at the time, we were just in development. So, like, for Please Like Me, it wasn't a big deal. But I was doing stand-up, you know? And I, like, built all this material, which was all true stories about bad dates I had with girls and, like, terrible things that happened while I was trying to have sex with girls. And I had to lose all my stand-up, which for a stand-up is just heartbreaking. To lose all your jokes.
Well, you could still have talked about terrible things that happened to you when you had sex with girls.
Yeah, but it was such like an awkward in. It was like, yeah, I'm gay now. And then trying to segue back to when I wasn't gay just to do this like old material. Like it was so awkward. I just had to like, I had to bin it and start again, which is like, that was the most traumatic part for me.
But it's kind of a goldmine in a way. It like opens the door to all this new material.
There's all this new stuff I could talk about. But then, because I like came out publicly and privately at the same time. So it was something that I never really... had a conversation about. Like, I told my friends and my parents, and we didn't really care that much. But then suddenly I was doing interviews, and people were, like, asking me questions. And it was like, oh, I've never actually spoken about this. So the first time I was doing it was, like, in a radio interview like this, or and then on stage. It was, like, a pretty weird situation.
So it sounds like there was no conversation with your parents. You slipped in there that you texted your father.
I texted my father, okay. And then...
Was that a clever way of avoiding any eye contact or the chance of any follow-up question or the possibility of meaningful conversation?
Oh, it's so grim. So he was coming to, like, visit me. Right, in where I lived in Melbourne, and I was living with my boyfriend. I'd been dating him for like 6 months, and he moved in way too quick. And I had to tell my dad because like my boyfriend lived in my house. You know, there's only one bedroom, so I texted him. I said, "Hey, what time is your flight getting tomorrow? Also, I have a boyfriend. See ya." And then he got like quite upset about texting him because it was like news that shouldn't be texted. And then I was sort of like, I just don't think this is something I need to be obliged to talk about, to be honest. And then he just spoke to me about AIDS for like a really long time. And it's sort of in the show where he like says like homosexuals are 30 times more likely to get, he said AIDS, but he meant HIV, but that's fine. And I was just like, I just don't think this is like a true fact. And also I'm across it, like I'm across condoms, like it's not like, it's actually not much different, you know, now that I'm gay, still got to wear a condom. I mean, babies are terrifying. You know, like, I know about this. That's all he wanted to talk about was HIV. And then my brother's gay as well, right? And he's older than me, and he's already come out. So that's why I think for them it was a bit boring. Like, they're a bit like, you know, you got to step it up, like, come back with bigger news, like, when you're a meth addict or something. And, my brother told her, and she started crying, but she cries a lot. And then she called me, and we just had that conversation, and then we never spoke about it again.
In the series, like, you're playing somebody named Josh who's slightly based on your life, and he really avoids emotional, meaningful conversations, like you apparently do too. But you're very perceptive as a writer about the subtext of people's conversations, about what's driving people emotionally. So it's not like you're not noticing emotions or incapable of either experiencing or reading them, but you just don't want to participate in discussion of them.
No, but I talk about my feelings all the time. It's just never in like a sad way. Mm-hmm. Do you know what I mean? We just don't like, me and my friends just don't get together and indulge in like, you know, panic about what we're doing with our lives or sadness. But I mean, nothing has happened in the last, like, my best friend in the show, Tom, I've known her since I was 12, And I mean, I've never had a feeling or have a moment in my life happen since we were 12 that he doesn't know about. Like, we talk about everything, but just not in like a really dramatic way. I don't know. I just think people are so keen to be sad these days. They really love it, you know? A lot of people just want to tell everyone how hard everything is, and they're probably fine.
So let's hear a scene from Please Like Me with your best friend in real life who plays your best friend in the series. And this is a scene you've just had your first kiss with a boy. And so this is the morning after, and you're going to the hospital because you just got a voicemail from your father saying that your mother, who's bipolar, just tried to kill herself with a lot of pills and with a lot of Baileys, which is a kind of whiskey cream liqueur.
It's a big day. It's a big day. That's a big day for anybody.
So you're on your way to the hospital with your friend Tom, and here's the conversation.
You've never left this much time between something happening and you telling me.
My mum took quite a bit of Panadol and drunk half a bottle of Baileys.
Baileys?
Yeah.
How do you even drink half a bottle of Baileys?
I just don't know. Guess what else?
You made out with Jeffrey.
I can never really trust with someone that good-looking is into me. Do you know what I mean? I just don't get it. Like, it's they're mediocre-looking, I can sort of appreciate why their standards are so low. But when they're that pretty, I'm just like, ugh. What are you hiding? You know?
Claire was quite good-looking.
I really don't think she was that good-looking when we got together. Puberty did well with her.
Just so I know, we're not talking about your mum because you're all, like, emotionally stunted, yeah?
Yeah.
And we're just ignoring the fact that Jeffrey's a man?
Yes.
Are you sure you don't have feelings you want to share with me in some kind of talk?
Yeah.
It can be good to share your feelings.
Nope. No. Nah.
Okay, that's a scene from the opening episode of Please Like Me, which stars my guest Josh Thomas, who also writes the series. So the line is really funny when you say you never trust it when somebody really good-looking is into you. Do you feel that way in real life?
Yeah, of course.
Why, of course?
Well, because if someone's mediocre-looking, it's just what I explained. I know why they're, like, trying to kiss me. I know where their flaws are, but if they're really pretty, then I know their flaws must be, like, personality-based, and you haven't discovered them yet, you know?
Do you think you are any more or less attractive as a straight man or a gay man? Do you know what I mean? Like, let me put it this way. The way you look, do you think you're physically more of a catch
I'm not physically
for girls or boys.
Catch. Uh-huh. No. But I'm like in Australia, I'm like properly on television all the time. So like I get to kiss people that are out of my league. Do you know what I mean?
Right.
On TV, you get to date out of your league.
But that gives you a pass in real life too. That kind of gives you an upgrade in real life.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. But then, yeah. I mean, anytime I've been on a date with someone who was like really pretty and who was into me, and this is kind of what like that Jeffrey character is based on, I've always really wanted to like make it work, because like that's a good I want like a super hot boyfriend, but the conversation's always been just so grim. It's always been quite tense for me because I'm desperate for them to be interesting. I try really hard to make it work, and then it never does.
So really the headline of the clip that we just played is that your mother in the series tries to take her life. And, you know, she's bipolar, and she tried to kill herself with pills and liquor. And fortunately, you know, she gets to the hospital in time and is saved. And I think that this is based in part on your own mother.
Yeah, that's like one of the truest storylines in the season is that kind of day. That voicemail I woke up and I like slept in until like 1 p.m. and then turned my phone on, and like it went backwards through the day, starting at 1 p.m. where they told me she was fine, and it went backwards to 9 a.m. and ended with her calling me just after she had like taken the pills. It's a pretty intense voicemail. And then I went to the hospital, and there's a scene in the show I'm in like visiting her in hospital, I think is pretty much verbatim, That's about as honest as we get, those two scenes.
My guest is Joss Thomas, the creator and star of the Australian sitcom Please Like Me, which is shown in the U.S. on the new cable channel Pivot TV. It's now showing season 2. More after a break. This is Fresh Air. Let's get back to my interview with Australian comic Joss Thomas. His semi-autobiographical sitcom, Please Like Me, is shown in the U.S. on the new cable channel Pivot TV. Here's a pretty autobiographical scene from the first episode. Joss's parents are divorced. His mother is in the hospital after attempting suicide. Joss is at the hospital, where he's spoken with one of the doctors, who's explained Joss's mother can't be left alone in her condition. She can be sent to an institution, or she can return home, but she can't live alone. Someone has to be with her. In this scene, Joss breaks the news to his mother, who's played by Deborah Lawrence.
So, what have you guys decided to do with me?
We haven't decided, that the doctor thinks we should put you in a mental home.
What do you think? Am I mental?
I don't know.
So what are the other options?
Well, someone needs to live with you. So that could be me, I guess, or Auntie Peg.
No. Don't make me move back in with her. I couldn't bear it.
Okay.
And you shouldn't have to live with me either, Joss. I shouldn't be your problem.
Well, I mean, I haven't decided. I'm not sure I could move out on Tom.
No, but you see, you could do all the same sorts of things at my place as you do at Tom's. It's okay, I'm cool with that.
Mum, you don't have to. I haven't decided. I'll think about it.
But you see, you could bring Claire home to sleep over if you
want.
I'm cool, okay? Like, you can have sex at the house if you want.
Oh,
no, please don't swear, Joss.
Also, Claire and I broke up.
What? Who broke up with who?
She broke up with me.
Oh, well, look, even if you want casual girls.
I'm not having sex in the house.
Well, I'm just saying you can if you want.
Well, I don't want to. Especially I don't want to with your permission.
No, I am just saying, okay?
Well, don't.
Okay. I won't.
How does your mother feel about being depicted in what's basically a comedy series?
Yeah, she was really, I mean, she loves it now, like, she's has ebbs and flows. I mean, at first, because I was like, obviously she has permission, right? So she has to give permission, she has to, like, she gets script approval, okay? Because you can't, because I've got characters based on her, we can't defame her. So she has to, like, she gets higher script approval than the networks do, her and my dad. And when I first, like, pitched it to her, like, 7 years ago, I was like, you know, I want to do the show, and I want the mum to attempt suicide because it's something that I know about, that I feel I can write about, and it's something that I haven't seen depicted on television, like, very honestly. And I knew that, like, when it happened to her, there was a lot of, she, like, felt like a lot of shame, and I was like, I don't think, like, that's what we need. I don't think it needs to be like that. And I think if we I could write a TV show where, like, I completely understand the situation, it's something I've lived through, like, I'm sort of I'm almost an expert on it, and I think it would be good. And she was like, she liked that, but she never understood how it could be a comedy, which, I mean, nobody did. I mean, it was the first question of every pitch meeting or with everybody. It was like, why do you think this can be funny? And then when she first watched it, I think she was still a bit confused. I think that's probably quite an intense experience for her to watch the show for the first time, especially because the show is just not like, it's not the type of television that she watches. And then she kind of, like, spoke to friends about it, and her friends saw it, and her friends all thought it was, like, really lovely about her and a really nice, I mean, she had, like, a few psychiatrists tell her that they thought it was a really good depiction of mental health, that, like, we had done what I told her I wanted to do. So now she, like, just thinks it's really lovely. She thinks it's just a really nice show about her, because it is, like, the show is really lovely to her. I don't think anybody would watch it and get to the end and think the mum is like a bad person or anything like that.
No, and your character so clearly loves his mother and vice versa.
Yeah, I think so. I mean, I think it's really nice to her. Just, I think when you're watching a show that nobody else has seen, because she's seeing it before anyone else and you've got no idea what people are going to think about it. And like, as well as like thinking about how she's depicted, she's thinking like, is my son going to be employed next year after making this TV? Like, is this any good? Do you know what I mean? I think that was probably like pretty intense, but she's like, came out the other side once it went to air, and she really thinks it's lovely now.
Why did you think you could make it funny that your mother had tried to commit suicide and has to deal with bipolar?
Honestly, I didn't think it was funny. I was like, it's not necessarily a comedy. Like, there's going to be scenes that are going to be sad. Like, I wanted to make a show that was sort of depicting life. And I've never understood this, like, comedy, drama, segregation. I've never, like, had a day or an experience that wasn't either completely hilarious or completely funny. I've had lots of, like, funny things happen that were humiliating, but were still very funny. And I've had a lot of sad things happen that have, like, moments of, like, joy and comedy in them. So I just wanted to, like, make sure we were doing that with every storyline. So the sad storylines have these sort of moments of joy and the you know, vice versa.
Josh Thomas will be back in the second half of the show. He's the creator and star of the Australian sitcom Please Like Me, which is shown in the U.S. on the new cable channel Pivot TV. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.
The Neubauer Family Foundation supports WHYY's Fresh Air and its commitment to sharing ideas and encouraging meaningful conversation. Support for NPR comes from NPR member stations and from Progressive Insurance, working to make progress for more than 75 years. From the School of Public and Environmental Affairs at Indiana University, Bloomington, SPIA is committed to preparing leaders and advancing knowledge for the greater good. And from Source America, researching and developing customized employment options for people with significant disabilities. SourceAmerica.org. This is NPR.
Coming up, Milo Miles reviews the new album by the indie band Tennis, and we continue our conversation with comedian Josh Thomas. Also, we remember Tony Auth, the Pulitzer Prize-winning editorial cartoonist. He died yesterday at 72. This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. Let's get back to my interview with comic Josh Thomas, the creator and star of the semi-autobiographical sitcom Please Like Me. It was created for Australian TV, but it's shown in the U.S. on the new cable channel Pivot TV. The series is about Josh realizing he's gay, and it's about his relationship with his divorced parents. In the first episode, his mother attempts suicide, like Thomas's own mother did. Did your mother try to kill herself more than once?
Oh, yeah, she did a few times, and we talk about it in series two. We don't ever show it again, because we've done it, you know.
So how old were you the first time when your mother tried to take her life?
Oh, gosh, I don't even know. I think it would have been, like, 18.
Did you take it personally that, you know, that she wouldn't go on living for your sake? Let me rephrase
such
that.
Such an interesting question.
Yeah.
I understand. Yeah. You don't need to rephrase it. I completely understand that. And it's like such an important question. It's kind of interesting doing this show because this season two, we've got a lot of other characters with mental illness and we're really exploring suicide much more in depth. And I never felt like it was about me. There's a scene in season two where, like, I say that, like, I just didn't think it was about me, right? I was like, always viewed it as like an illness, and she wasn't in, like, you know, I was like she's crazy, like she's making a crazy decision because she's got a mental disorder. Like, that's something that, like, I always thought was pretty clear, but other people involved didn't feel that way. Like, a lot of our family members were really angry at her for, like, what they were like, why would you do this to me? And I had this interesting did this interview with this lady who was bipolar, and she was talking about when she gets depressed and committing suicides, and I mentioned, like, people getting angry about it, and she was like, well, for her, when she was in, like, such a dark place, like, in such a low place in that depression, she, like, hated herself so much that she actually thought she was doing everyone a favor. Like, she didn't think she was doing it to everybody. Like from our point of view, we think, like, why are you putting, you know, taking a risk that means that I'm going to lose you? But they're thinking, like, I'm going to do this as a favor so you don't have to deal with the burden of me, which I thought was, like, a really interesting thing. I don't know if that's what happened with my mom. Do you know what I mean?
Mm-hmm.
But that's what, you know, we put that in the show because I thought that was really an interesting angle. And you don't really know, like, why people are attempting suicide. I think taking it personally is, like, it's like a weird choice to make. It's easier not to take it personally, so I just don't.
You started your stand-up comedy career when you were 17, which is pretty young to be performing. How did you get your start that early?
I did, like, a stand-up comedy, amateur comedy competition, and I won it. Because I just wasn't, like, thinking things through, do you know what I mean? Because I was 17. Like lots of people make stupid choices when they're 17. Sometimes it involves, like, unprotected sex, but for me, I just, like, started doing stand-up because I didn't think it through. And it worked out fine for me.
What was your comedy like when you were 17?
Lots of jokes about how everyone thinks I'm gay, but I'm not gay.
Oh, seriously?
that's my first
hysterical.
Big routine.
Oh, tell us one or two of those jokes.
God, I can't remember them. And I don't want to remember them, to be honest. Well, this is also interesting. I had this stand-up routine about my mum taking me to the shops and, like, losing her mind and buying me condoms and being really loud and, like, laughing and just being absurd. And at the time, she wasn't diagnosed as bipolar. I just had this story about my mum being embarrassing. And then it turns out she was bipolar. And then the rest of the story was about me not being gay. So, pretty interesting stand-up routine looking back.
Makes you sound so clueless.
So clueless. I am pretty clueless. Plus, I was 17. I mean, of course, I had no idea.
So, looking back on your life, why do you think people assumed that you were gay and you assumed that you weren't?
I didn't know. It was one of my jokes when I came out was how I didn't understand how I didn't know and everyone ever drove past me in a pickup truck did. I just wasn't paying that much attention. Plus, like, I was having sex with girls when I was a teenager and it was fun. Because, like, it's fun when you're a teenager to just put it anywhere. Like, that's a fun time. That's a fun afternoon, you know? Like, it's... But then, like, I grew up and then I came to terms with the fact that maybe it wasn't for me. Also, one of the big driving factors of me sort of coming to terms with it and coming out was I, like, fell in love with a boy. Because, like, everyone always talks about, like, sex when they're talking about homosexuality. But the thing is, if you can't be sexually attracted to someone, you're not going to fall in love with them. Do you know what I mean? Like, if you're straight, you're not going to be able to feel romantic feelings for your best friend of the same gender, even though they're possibly very attractive and incredible to hang out with. Like, it's just not going to happen. So when I, like, fell in love with a boy, I was like, oh, all these other relationships I had, that was just me having sex with a friend. But this is, like, different, and that forced me to, like, come to terms with it.
So your stand-up comedy led to opportunities on television, including a show called Talking About Your Generation. And Americans don't know the show, so I'm going to ask you to explain it.
It's like a game show. It's, I guess, you guys have what it's called, Hollywood Tonight or...
Hollywood Game Night. I've seen ads
Hollywood
for
Game
I
Night?
I haven't seen the show. Yeah.
Yeah, yeah. It's, it, yeah. that's like, I think, the closest thing you have, where they play like parlor games and it's like kind of some of the same people every week. We do a lot of that television in Australia. So it was like this game show where Generation Y, which you call millennials, Generation X and baby boomers like battled it out. And I was on there every week and we played like wacky games. It was very wacky. It was the number one rating show in Australia for a while, which doesn't say a lot about our country.
So there's an episode where you're on a team with your grandmother and one of you has to answer the trivia question, the pop culture trivia questions, and the other one is going to get strapped into a chair with their arms in restraints and three buckets over their heads. And for every wrong answer, a bucket is going to get dumped on the head. There's a bucket of sour cream, guacamole, and hot sauce. And so you end up, at your grandmother's suggestion, she gets into the chair. You end up answering the questions. And you get, I think, just one of them wrong, and she gets the sour cream dumped on her head. And you look kind of upset, but not so upset that you seriously say, this must stop. In good conscience, I cannot allow this to happen. Did you know that she was going to volunteer to do this? Was this worked out in advance?
We have had producers walk onto that set twice. We made the show for 4 years and stopped the show mid-recording, and that was one where she was like, I'll get in. Because, like, she's not meant to get in. Like, they didn't want her to get in. They wanted me to get in. Nobody wanted her to get in. I didn't want her to get in. But she really wanted to go in the big torture device. And she's 82, right? And the host of the show, Sean, he's, like, a really decent guy. And he was like, we're not going to tell her she's not allowed to do it. Like, she's an adult. You know what I mean? You can't not let her make choices. You can't say like, oh, what if you were like, if she was 75, would we let her? Like if she wants to go in the machine, we have to let her do it. I mean, nobody wanted to. Like, I would much prefer to have sour cream poured on my head than be on television watching my grandma have sour cream poured on her head. You know, she just had the time of her life. She just loved it. The sour cream gets poured on her head and she has nachos and she like starts eating the sour cream off her dress. I mean, that's funny. She killed
it. Right. Well, does your grandmother have any kind of background in show business?
No. She's just, I mean, I've never seen her have that much fun. She was like, oh, no one's ever done my makeup. And they like flew her down business class and like the audience just loved her. And she just had like the funnest day. And I think you can tell when you watch the show, but I had a few people get like angry at me in supermarkets for doing it. Not that I did it. I just stood by.
And what was the conversation like afterward? She was happy about it?
Oh, she was so happy. Like, I just think it's one of the best days she's had in the last couple of years. Really went on like an adventure, you know? I mean, sometimes I talk to her, I say, like, how's it going, Grandma? And she says, oh, just waiting to die. like it's grim. Do you know what I mean? Like, it's not like.
Does she mean to be funny when she says that?
No. No,
she's sorry, I laugh then. Okay.
No, it's fine. She's really religious. So she's like, she's actually excited about it. She's really looking forward to seeing my granddad again.
Is she sorry that you're not religious?
No. I mean, she completely understands. And she, you know, in season one, there's that scene where Aunt Peg, this is kind of pseudo grandma, called Aunt Peg and not grandma because I didn't want to make my grandma sign a release form. But she stands up in church and does that like rant at the priest, at him for being homophobic. There's like a scene where she does that. And that was like, my grandma did that. That's like almost verbatim what my grandma did.
What did your grandmother say to the priest?
She told me, she said, I was sitting in church the other day and he was telling everyone that gay people are going to go to hell and that gay people are bad. And I stood up and I said, I have three gay grandsons. And then she said, actually, Josh, at the time you hadn't come out, I had two, but I've changed it. I have three gay grandsons and they're good people and they don't have a choice. And, you know, they don't get to pick the color of their eyes and they don't get to pick their sexuality. And we should love them all the same. Jesus said something and we should love them all the same. And then she like sat back down, just this tiny 80-something-year-old woman standing up against the church. I think it sounds pretty incredible to me. I wasn't there. I didn't get to see it.
So what's next for you? You have a second season that's on now.
And then we're doing season three. Uh-huh. Americans are always asking me what's next. They always want to know what's next. I have a job, okay?
But who knows for how long?
I have my own TV show. Everyone can just relax. I'm doing enough. They want to know, like, what else I'm doing. Calm down, America. I have my own TV show. I'm 27. I have my own TV show. I'm doing all right. I'm doing season three. Season three's been commissioned. So we're doing that. I'm writing season three at the moment. And that's everything. That's all my time.
Okay. Whew, what a relief. I was so worried about you. Yeah. Okay.
Yeah. I don't need to. I'm employed for at least another year. And then I'll worry about what's next.
All right.
So ambitious. This country's so ambitious.
Well, Josh Thomas, it's really been great talking with you. Thank you so much. Good luck with the series.
Thanks so much.
Josh Thomas is the creator and star of the Australian sitcom Please Like Me, which is shown in the U.S. on the new cable channel Pivot TV. Coming up, Milo Miles reviews a new album by the indie band Tennis. This is Fresh Air. This is Fresh Air. Can you reinvent lively pop from the distant past? Music critic Milo Miles says the songwriting team Tennis does just that with their new third album called Ritual in Repeat. Tennis is singer Alana Moore and guitarist Patrick Riley.
Alana Moore and Patrick Riley are clearly passionate fans of the rock and soul sounds of the early 60s girl groups and Brill-building songwriters and producers. However, their new album, Ritual and Repeat, is a triumph, not because it conveys their fandom, but because it makes a sprightly pop style from 50 years ago fresh, ready for new fans now. This is a much trickier task than it might seem. Right through the 70s and into the 80s, reviving earlier modern rock and pop could rely on nostalgia and expert recreation. Elton John celebrated an oldie he made up in Crocodile Rock, and the ska revival in Britain grafted current political protest onto a vintage Jamaican sound. Eventually, the process broke down if he wanted to attract a younger audience with no living memory of the original style. By the 1990s, the so-called swing revival was able to reduce jump blues to a mere dress-up party. Since then, reviving vintage pop modes has only become riskier. Country bumps along if it stays plain-spoken and storytelling. But no question, styles imply a sensibility. Heavy metal doo-wop is always going to be a goof. So how to renovate the Brill Building? Tennis knows you start with songs that are quirky, pretty, and saucy with just the right tone.
Looking back from the outer edge, I'm still the same. Looking back from the
I doubt any vocalist other than Alana Moore could nail the trills, carefully carefree repetitions, and nonverbal interjections that rise like bubbles through Tennis tunes. This is key because Tennis is more sounds, or at least moods, than stories or characters. Sure, you can hear there are boys and girls in love tangles, and Tennis is rather more pastoral than its city-bound roots. And I think the song Bad Girls, for example, is about why the singer got married. But I was infatuated with the tune long before I cared what it was about. Ritual and Repeat loses momentum in the second half, and the couple tracks that are mere comely baubles are stuck there. But it still knocks the old out of oldies better than any album in years. Tennis does not do simple revival or recreation or even just repeat the rituals, so I pondered for quite a while what Moore and Riley's singular abilities suggested. Was it a marvelous actor interpretation, bringing back the feel of girl groups the way Chadwick Boseman reignites the spirit of James Brown? That still seemed too tied to the sources. On Ritual and Repeat, it's like Moore and Riley discovered just how much ancient Latin, or in this case, extinct pop styles, is their natural language. They are fluent in brill building.
Milo Miles reviewed Ritual and Repeat, the new album from the band Tennis. Coming up, we remember Tony Off, a Pulitzer Prize-winning editorial cartoonist who was also our colleague here at WHYY. This is Fresh Air. This is Fresh Air. We got some very sad news yesterday. Pulitzer Prize-winning editorial cartoonist Tony Off died at the age of 72. He had metastatic brain cancer. He worked at the Philadelphia Inquirer for 41 years and was nationally syndicated. He also illustrated children's books. For the last 2 years, he was our colleague here at WHYY, where he was our first digital artist in residence, contributing cartoons, illustrations, and animated videos for our NewsWorks website. His position at WHYY worked out well for me. Tony illustrated a talk that I gave with animations that accompanied the interview excerpts I played. It was a privilege to work with him and see a bit of his creative process. We're going to listen back to an excerpt of an interview I did with Tony back in 1988 after the publication of a collection of his editorial cartoons called Lost in Space, The Reagan Years. He told me that in looking back on the Reagan era, he believed that Reagan's attack on domestic social programs marked a turning point for many political cartoonists.
When he started devastating various domestic programs, and especially since the Reagan administration was using the term truly needy. And that was something that we could latch onto and use against the administration. They stopped using that term. And it was, in fact, in reaction against one of my cartoons, I'm told.
Describe the cartoon that it was a reaction to.
Well, I think the one they said was when I had them launching a presidential yacht, which Reagan had named the Truly Needy.
Now, how did this get back to you?
The New Yorker did a piece on it, and they mentioned that in the piece.
So that shows that a cartoonist can actually have some influence, which is something
strange,
I'm sure you've doubted,
true.
Right? No, but seriously, I bet you have doubted that.
Of course.
Washington correspondents, when they're covering a president, they travel with the president. They're there for the press conferences. They'll go on the road if the president goes on the road. How do you get your take on the president? Is it by reading? Do you ever go see the president? Or
no, I think that would be a very counterproductive activity. no, it's very essentially lonely work. I mean, I spend more time reading than doing anything else.
Mm-hmm.
The cartoonists, though, as an organization, meet every other year in Washington, and they try desperately to see the president. And the last time, they had a Rose Garden audience, and I boycotted it because I just think it's really silly.
Why do you think it's silly?
Well, because I think in that kind of a situation, the president is trying to use the cartoonists. And I think that more than anything else, the atmosphere that is, the attitude that is generated by the president and they're trying to get everybody to buy into is one that, well, you know, basically you guys draw these funny pictures and we're the politicians and we're all in this together and it's not very serious.
So you take it more seriously than that. It's not just little jokes.
Well, I think cartoonists have a problem being taken seriously in any event, and I do everything I can to not play the clown and to not have that attitude be accepted. And a lot of cartoonists cooperate with that. I mean, they wear strange clothes and they joke about who they're going to vote for, who's the easiest to draw, all that kind of stuff.
Who's the easiest to draw? Now that really cheapens the political message of a cartoon.
Of course, as if what we were about was filling the editorial pages with people that we could draw easily.
The introduction to your book is written by your friend and colleague, cartoonist Jules Pfeiffer. And I want to read a couple of things that Pfeiffer has to say about you. Tony Auth's cartoons are not just funny, they have true political content. Unlike too many of his colleagues, Auth doesn't pick on Ronald Reagan for his superficial defects. His argument is with Reagan's extremism, callousness, hypocrisy, and ignorance, all of which he presents to us with humor. I wonder what your reaction is. I don't mean to put you on the spot and have you pass judgment on your colleagues, but do you agree with Pfeiffer that a lot of political cartoons today are funny, but they don't really have political grit? They don't really go to the heart of the political issue?
Well, that is a problem that cartoonists often talk about when they get together. There is a tendency to do gags about the headlines,
mm-hmm,
and to print them on the editorial page. And what comes to mind is Jerry Ford and all the cartoons and commentary about him bumping his head. And I never did one cartoon about him bumping his head because the fact of the matter is he's probably the greatest athlete that we've ever had elected president. He slips once. You know, if people were photographing us all the time, God knows what the...
Oh, not me.
But actually, I did use it once as a metaphor for him slipping in with regard to some sort of policy or something. That, to me, makes it work, and then you can use that as a metaphor.
Mm-hmm.
But to do jokes about somebody hitting their head is just... You know, so what?
You got started, didn't you, at Underground Papers?
Yes.
That must have been good in the sense that you were really expected to be outspoken there. Anything goes.
I had more trouble there than at the Inquirer.
No, really?
Yes, because Underground editors tended to think that they knew the truth.
Oh, so you had to be politically correct.
Right. The worst thing for a cartoonist is to have an editor who thinks he knows the truth.
Funny how that works. You came of age as a cartoonist with Watergate.
Yes.
Well,
Vietnam and Watergate.
Okay. Was it in some
Was it good for Tony Auth that there was Watergate? That's not what I mean. but I mean, you had issues.
Paradox.
I know, but you had issues that really mattered to people when you started cartooning professionally.
Well, I think
I'm not saying that issues now don't matter, but there are times when there aren't really big issues.
Yes, and I think that political cartoonists are caused by social upheaval. I would have been a medical illustrator, as I was, had it not been for Vietnam and then Watergate. And in the 50s, in the very early 60s, Herblock and Conrad and Malden used to sit around and say, what's happening to our profession? It's dying. We have no new blood. And all they needed was a Vietnam and a civil rights movement, followed by a Watergate, what you had was waves of cartoonists being, put ashore, who otherwise would have been something else.
Tony, thanks a lot for talking with
us. Thank you, Terry.
Editorial cartoonist Tony Auth recorded in 1988. He died of metastatic brain cancer yesterday at the age of 72. He worked at the Philadelphia Inquirer for 41 years and was our colleague at WHYY for the past 2 years as our first digital artist in residence. We will miss him. Fresh Air's executive producer is Danny Miller. Our senior producer is Roberta Shurrock. Our technical director and engineer is Audrey Bentham. Dorothy Farabee is our administrative assistant. Our associate producer for online media is Molly C.V. Nesper. John Sheehan directed the show. I'm Terry Gross.
Support for NPR comes from NPR member stations and from America's Natural Gas. Learn how UPS is reducing emissions in communities with their growing fleet of natural gas vehicles. ThinkAboutIt.org. From Fox Broadcasting, with the new drama Red Band Society, starring Octavia Spencer, premiering Wednesday after Hell's Kitchen on Fox. And from Angie's List, where consumers can browse, buy, and schedule local services online. More at angieslist.com. This is NPR.
On the next Fresh Air, we talk with Pulitzer Prize-winning journalist Lawrence Wright. His new book is about the peace agreement between Egypt and Israel that was brokered by President Carter at Camp David. Wright is also the author of The Looming Tower, about the history of Al-Qaeda, and Going Clear, Scientology, Hollywood, and the Prison of Belief. Join us.